Good evening. I'm Professor Vincent. So nice to be here on campus, my name. I'm director of continuing education, but this evening I'm acting as a representative of the tactical department that administrates and has responsibility for the winter lecture. I bring the greetings of our president and teacher. If you'd like to be here, he happens to be at one of the district conventions. He's attending a lot of district conventions this year to do a little public relations and interpretation for the seminar. He asked me to give you his greetings, and I'm glad to do so. I'll let you in on a little secret. I think Pastor Miller already knows it. John Keating was elected president of the seminary, he was scheduled to be here tonight as a winter lecturer. He was number one for 1970, and Charles Miller was not number two, but he was number one for 71. So when John Keating was elected president, we thought he would have enough pressures, enough problems without producing a lectureship this early in his administration. And we excused him and moved Pastor Miller from 71 back to 70. I'm sure he doesn't mind being next in line for our president. I will not repeat the material on the brochures. You receive them in the mail. You have them in hand. Senator Coughlin, a couple others asked me a little bit about this lectureship. Let me begin on a personal note. I came here in 1950. This lectureship was established in 1950 by the late J. Frederick Winter of Washington, D.C. I came here in 1954 as director of seminary relations, and one of the first things I did was to see what funds we had available, and I read the brochure that set up this lectureship. And I heard the first winter lecture here in 1954, as a week, and talked on all or nothing. And it was very impressive. I still remember him speaking on that theme. For 7 years, I directed seminary relations and had to publicize the lectures and helped set them up. And so they've been very closely connected with my life here at the seminary, and they've meant a great deal to me. I think every one of them has been a highlight, and I've heard it. You'll notice on the list of distinguished speakers here, 14 men in 18 years, some of the outstanding preachers in our church have shared with faculty and students and the pastoral conference. And they certainly enriched our life. We may not have 100 here, but the lectures have been printed and sent throughout the church. They've been taped, and some of you as first-year students have listened to tapes of previous lectures as a requirement, and usually said it was one requirement that was very edifying and encouraged you to teach in the parish ministry. So these are being recorded to and will reach a larger audience than is here, and you'll hear Pastor Miller tomorrow. When Dr. Winter set up this foundation, he said three things that I had to do between the age of 45 and 55. Pastor Miller was a 40 man, the right side of 40. He needs that requirement. Number two, I had to be active in the ministry. If you read his record, send it in the folder. He's been very active in the ministry, increasingly so. And he must be known as an effective preacher. Well, knowing Pastor Miller, talking to a lot of others who know him even better than I, they say he meets all of these qualifications very fully. The summary of his service, his ministry, is in the folder. He wrote a little book, The Strategy of Evangelism. I have a class upstairs in Paul's Evangelism, and he wrote it last week. So he's contributing also to classes and other works. His reputation as a speaker, a preacher, a lecturer around the country, and a very interesting writer. His little series of articles in the LLR paper on the mission affirmation. Still special, I think, and I have to read that. So here we are talking about pastoral preaching in the parish right after Easter. And Pastor Miller is tired, I'm sure, as many of you are, who preached a lot. He had five services on Friday. I'm not sure you were coming.
Yeah.
I don't know what he's going to say.
I don't know.
He just combined. had five of them on Saturday, marriage on Saturday, three on Sunday, funeral on Monday, and here he is talking about preaching for us here. So he's not tired of preaching, maybe a little tired from preaching, but he's here to enlarge our vision and to help us get new zeal and zest and will for preaching as we should do it. Recently I saw a cartoon, and I'll close with this stuff. There was another church denomination convention, and the MC was introducing an angel. He had a halo and he had wings. He was obviously on the left. And he said it gives me great pleasure to introduce our next speaker who was flown in at great expense. So from Silver Spring, Maryland, flown in at great expense, and the airline should finally get in here, Pastor Charles Miller.
We don't know the mixed feelings that a man who has been 17 years in the seminary feels to come back here again. This place is loaded, like Ed Winkler, this place is loaded with memories and feelings of every kind of natural. And I think one of the reasons why I agreed to do something like this is I don't know what kind of standards Dr. Winkler put into the criteria for doing the speaker, but I really care about the church, and I really care about the prayer. I'm not sure I can do a whole lot about the church, but I think I can do a good deal in talking about the prayer. So I'd like to kind of tell you what I've been doing on my own, because I think the necessary thing is going to be for a lot of men to get out and do this kind of work. Greg Winning, a man who was my father and just a lovely human being, and by chance was Dr. Winkler's successor, told me one time, never say no. No matter what anyone asks you to do, never say no if you're safe. For about the last 10 years, I have not said no. I've been to places I would never believe I would get. I have tried to do things that I would never have the courage to try otherwise. And I have sort of mumbled into my dress at that man so many times that there was a kind of concern. I had a kind of a visceral feeling about what the church was going on with this. I have this feeling. I think a lot of people have it. It's a very positive feeling. It's a very exciting feeling. I do not see what a lot of the negatives in the church are saying for. I just don't see it. But every time that I would start to talk, someone would say, well, you went there. You ought to go to. You ought to see. And so I began. I went. I've been to Wisconsin, I've been to Michigan, I've been to New York, I've been to most of the New England states, I've been down this coast, I even accept my time to speak in Perry County, and I thought that would really be the dead center of Lutheranism, and I found all kinds of excitement there. I found men and women everywhere. I talked to lay groups and pastor groups, and the interesting thing is about halfway through any presentation, someone will say, now, your executive secretary is what? Nothing. Well, now, which board are you representing? None. Well, what are you doing here? Well, I got this invitation. And I did too. And I always made it my business to spend time with pastors. I'll tell you an interesting thing that happened. I found that I can last 1 week on the road. 1 week. Because you always have the sort of bank in the afternoon. You go to a church, you make a presentation in the evening, the guy discovers you're kind of human, and then he wants to sit down and begin talking with you. And I found out that after five consecutive nights of sitting up to 4 o'clock in the morning talking, I just couldn't take it anymore, physically. And I found all kinds of things out there. I think our ministers generally put themselves down. I think they are enormously guilty of the Hebrew 8th commandment, not themselves, but in what other people say, and listening to what other people say. The judge didn't get something else to me. Greg Winning said the following, and gentlemen, if you're going to ministry, this is the greatest advice that you can receive to keep things happy. Whenever anybody says there are a lot of people who feel that, your response is name three. Name three. There's been more trouble than I've heard. Stop. There's me, and there's my wife, and then there's my brother-in-law. And you say, okay, now we know where we are. And as you go out and begin touching, beginning feeling people, you realize that the Spirit is alive in the church. and the Lord Christ's name, which you really must say. And I heard somewhere a very interesting story. It seems to be a good place to begin, a way to begin. Around the turn of the century, there were the two little children in Buckingham Palace. The children of the king and queen, the Duke of York and the Duke of Edinburgh. And they used to sit and stick their little noses to the window and look outside and watch the little street urchins having an enormously wonderful time, but they could never go out there. And they would watch and watch, and they'd want to get out there with each trip, just chasing back and forth. And finally, one snowy day, they darted through the guards and got out there, and it was dirty and it was slushy, and before you knew it, they were all surfing, having a tremendous time, throwing snowballs and everything else. And one kid threw a snowball and it hit a lamp. And the lamp broke. And immediately there was an English Bobby there and he just started yelling at kids. And he hauled him down and got the whole bunch now in front of the judge. The judge starts in the left and he says to the first one, "Who are you?" He says, "Yeah, I am the Duke of Edinburgh." He said, "Young man, don't be impertinent in here. This is a court of law. Who are you?" He says, "Yeah, I know, I'm the Duke of Edinburgh." The judge continued to regale on the podium like, "You can't talk that way. Who are you?" And he didn't get up. He was the Duke of Edinburgh. Came to the next one. And he said, "Who are you?" He says, "I'm the Duke of York." And he joined into his whole process, and the kid didn't get up at all. And he turned to the next kid. His nose was too dark. And he said, "Now, who are you?" And he says, "Your Honor, I sit with my friend. I'm the Archbishop of Canada." So, I'm with you, sitting with my friend. I take this opportunity to speak with you, my brethren, with confusing feelings of considerable reluctance and joyful anticipation. I'm not disturbed by this apparent contradiction of emotion, for this is only another illustration of the paradoxical quality implicit, I think, in the pastoral mentality and explicit in any significant pastoral preaching. Pastoral Christian preaching generally takes place in the middle ground between emotional and theological and intellectual polarity. That's one way of saying that we live with contradiction. As an example, when the systematicians have had their day and organized everything into comprehensibility, and when the popular writers in turn have turned their hand at making the divine understandable, we are still left with all the tensions of the theological mystery, just last Sunday, Easter. Man, you can't do anything with it, but say, it happened. It's dead. Christ speaking with complete insight and clarity on the Trinity, with its three in one, explain to me how faith and work are really harmoniously entwined. Or present again the amazing truth of the human and divine nature of Christ so that I can truly countenance this condition. Or show me the rationale of concurrent attitudes of fear and love toward God. My brothers, we can announce these things, we can present them, we can accept them, we can believe them. But beware of the temptation that all of this means that we understand them, or that somehow or another, they can be sensibly and intelligently presented with metaphors about trains and tracks, about ships and rudders, about bridges and chasms, about husbands and wives, or any of the million or more limp illustrations we are prone to use for clarity. Our best attempts in these areas highlight a facet here or a facet there. Our risks obscure and confuse the whole matter. The fact is that we spin out our lives in the confusing country of the divine mystery. The realization of this makes us touch all things, including life itself, with under air. There still abides God's commentary on human-divine relationships. My thoughts are not your thoughts. Neither are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For if the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, in my thoughts than your thoughts. And that's a rather lengthy way of saying that over the years, I've become comfortable in the ministry with its lively tension. I am, as a parish pastor, well acquainted with life in the middle ground. And in that posture, I can both be touched with reluctance and reaching in anticipation. It didn't take me long to determine the path of these two lectures. Almost before I had read the last paragraph of the invitation to share with you a few hours of conversation and encouragement in the area of preaching, I knew the direction it had to go if I were to be the speaker. The title I chose, Pastoral Preaching, and I've added a word to people in the parish, is only accidentally alliterative, but it grows from personal conviction, from some experience, and from much sharing with co-workers who are hard at work trying to explore the dimensions of their vocation. I might as well be honest from the beginning and tell you that there won't seem to be a great deal said about preaching, and yet it will all be about preaching, and that's another paradox. The direction of content stems from my growing understanding of what it means to be pastor, and in a real sense from my acquaintance with the man in whose name these lectures are offered. I'd like to say a few things about him, for in many ways he lived this paper before I ever tried to write it. I knew Dr. Russell in his declining years, but not really as a close acquaintance. He and I attended some meetings together, and I heard him speak a few times. My first view of him came from a second source. His friended successor at Christ Lutheran Church in Washington, D.C., the Reverend William F. Grinning. Through Pastor Grinning's eyes, I came to see some of the stellar Christian qualities which Dr. Wentworth possessed. And a third source of insight comes from many of Dr. Wentworth's parishioners, some of whom still share my views today and listen to me each Sunday with great care and much love. On the basis of their testimony and my limited personal knowledge, I can say that Dr. Wentworth was not a great preacher in any classical sense of the term, but he wanted to be. Dr. Wentworth thought that good preaching, even great preaching, must be the hallmark of the Lutheran pulpit. Personally, he was taught in the German American translation of our church with all that inspired. He bloomed in the period where beloveds and almost Caesarean English was preaching, Caesarean English preaching was abroad in the land. And facing those obstacles, he never really made it as a perfect orator. But as a churchman and as a pastor and as a leader, and as a sensitive pioneer of the faith, as a student, he was a giant. When he died, a portion of his library was offered to the Washington Pastoral Conference, and I was amazed at how many books on preaching he had there. As I dug through the collection, I noticed books about preaching, about the use of voice, about oratory, and many other things, and when you page through these books, you would find newspaper clippings of sermons tucked here and there in the book, and notes penciled on the margins, and well-timed phrases underlined, and critical comments at the end of some sermon. He was really a student of preaching. In addition, he was a pioneering innovator. Much that is normal and casually assumed in parish practice in the 70s was novel and daring and almost heretical in his time. He arduously cut many a first path across untapped areas of human encounter, areas which you and I now share along at high speed, with no conscious awareness that someone else is our first to pick the path. This series of lectures at this seminary is but one such example of his vision and his concern. And even if you forget the name of the man in whose name these lectures are offered, I hope that all of you will walk with the realization that he and many others like him went before us. They laid much of the pastoral foundation, the style of life, which will guide our tools of service in the Lord's vineyard. If the astronauts could pay their homage to the past by saying, "We stand on the shoulders of giants," you and I as Christian workers must echo these words in space. There is a Dr. Wentworth embedded in our history, and he does not stand alone. He stands in the company of thousands. We draw from their experiences and their adventures of all these nameless men each day. In their turning time, they built the platforms on which all the great men of the past at one moment or another of Christian history stood. I mention this not only to honor their memory, but also to emphasize their style of life. Their heroic faith and the generally unnoticed service in the shadow of the great and the near great will be the pasture which most of us will have to assume in our ministry. As John the Baptist and his prophetic precursors, most of us too will go before to prepare the way for others who will place the divine mark writ large on some event or expression or understanding of God's great good will for men in Christ's future. It is to you, the majority, who will not evangelize the millions in massive gatherings or utter final pronouncements which will shape the course of Christian history, or teach with superb authority the under humanity that seek guidance that I address myself. You will spend out your time serving as a parish pastor and teaching the word every seventh day, more or less. I want to say this is a great way to live, it's a thrilling way to serve, and it's an exhilarating and meaningful expenditure of life. I'm going to talk a little bit more about this tomorrow morning in the chapel, because what I'll note then is that, is the number of guys that are leaving the parish ministry today. Number of guys are leaving the parish ministry. I thank you tonight that you can think about it. Between 1967 and 1969, the Protestant ministry was about 425,000. 62,000 men left. 62,000. Now, you think about that. What's amazing about it, is that 65,000 left the parish ministry. So some of these are just the executives and others and pastors and professors who moved back into the parish. I want to say that an awful lot of people don't think the parish is worth working with. And I also want to say, just as clearly, that I believe that it is the greatest possible way that you can live your life. It is as a parish pastor, not just by accident, but by personal and divine intent, that I want to share some of the thinking about one of the key pastoral functions, and it's only one of the functions, and that is teaching. I make no apology when I say this is not intended to be definitive. I think we've had just about enough definitive stuff in our history. If it contributes but a little to the much larger whole, I will be satisfied. Speaking with pastors and potential pastors about teaching offers all kinds of possibilities. We might discuss style or theological content or oratorical technique. As talking to Professor Ryan ahead of time, I read all kinds of stuff. Isn't it fun me coming here and regurgitating to you what these men and you have right here to come to know full well, much better than you are. So I turn you to them for some things and take one little piece of the preaching power and focus on that for the next few hours. I would like to accent in our time together three words: pastor, people, and parish, particularly as these three words apply to preaching. I do this because I believe understanding the dimensions of these words is central to good preaching. Pastor preaching does not take place by virtue of seminary graduation. I don't even think it can be taught. I'm sure most of the returning vicars of last year are by now aware of that, or at least have a haunting suspicion that such is the case. Pastoral preaching is quite distinct from that which takes place in chapel exercises, or rally sermonizing, or when a capable communicator is asked to speak at a congregational anniversary, or dedication, or ordination for that matter. Pastoral preaching is the kind of preaching that goes on in which the shared joys and miseries and heartaches and hopes between the pastor and a given band of people meet head on. It begins to break ground during the early months of ministry in a given place, and it comes to full bloom only after as much as 5 or 10 years of first quarter living. It's not totally unlike courting. The first day often is expiring that. But after that, it improves and it gets better and better and better as the relationship deepens and then passes through the gates of engagement and marriage and childbearing and developing the family and the peace of the advanced years. I think that's an enormous power to what I'm talking about when I'm talking about pastoral preaching. The difference between pastoral preaching and other varieties of preaching is the difference between eating fried imperial in a fine restaurant and eating at home where your wife or your mother offers hamburger as the main course again. But the main course in that instance is more than just hamburger. It's my wife's hamburger or my mother's hamburger. And the ingredient in that kind of concoction includes ground beef and eggs, perhaps some breadcrumbs, suitable seasoning, plus the entire history of that little band of people who share that meal, flavored with all that makes them a family and shares that with heaping portions of confirmed interrelationship. It's hard to make hamburgers exciting for the 700th time. But there is a compensatory excitement and joy that flavors the food simply because it is the 700th time. Those hamburgers then are more than food to be worked down with the greatest speed possible. They are love, and they are care, and they are concern, and sharing, and warmth, and forgiveness, and a desire for oneness to be slowly savored and finally consumed with pleasure. It is that kind of understanding of teaching that helps me interpret a fact that visiting teachers don't go over very well in my church. Pastor Dillon first told me about this phenomenon. When a guest teacher comes, attendance doesn't go up, it goes down. If we announce in advance that a guest will occupy the pulpit, great effort must be exerted to accent the family church where the occasion which prompts the invitational attendance drop. We've gone through about 7 vicars. Every one of the actors are learners themselves. They all are kind of sure that when it comes to teaching, you know, we've arrived, but the people haven't heard the word yet. And I keep telling them, when people ask you who's preaching next Sunday, don't talk. And they don't, really. They start saying things like, next Sunday after the sermon, I'm still going to need something for my throat when I come over to your house. And they gotta do it. They gotta do it. And the first thing that happens is when they really let the man, the bottom drops out of a tent. And that's a hurt guy you're talking to there. But the reason is that the quality of the relationship between the pulpit and the pew suffers, not necessarily that the quality of the preaching suffers. Preaching is much more pastoral presence than content on the parish level. I want to say that again, and I took my glasses off, I can't see this, but it's just the wrong height for me. Preaching is much more pastoral presence than content on the parish level. I worried a great deal about that sentence. And I was worried first because it sort of popped out of the typewriter and appeared on the paper almost against my will. I worried secondly because it seemed to call into question a lot of what I've read and what I was taught about preaching. And so I started out on a number of fine laymen and some brothers in the ministry. Les Beitler and I had quite a talk together on this particular thing. The brothers in the ministry were bothered by everyone. They wondered whether it was Lutheran. They wonder whether it's confessional, they wonder whether it's theological, and they keep repeating. Preaching is much more pastoral presence than content on the church level. But I tried it out on a dozen different laymen, and they all said, "Thanks. We've known that for years, and we've been trying to say that to you. But I'm still not quite comfortable with that sentence. I don't think I want to defend it. The more you think about it, the more implications it insinuates, so I brought it out here to leave it with you. And I'd like to know how comfortable it fits with you. But I think your people in general would agree with it. I believe they don't really know the difference between a good sermon and a bad one, at least not by the criteria which the professional might use. Every once in a while, someone puts out one of these forms that you're supposed to give out to your parents and give them a chance to respond. I've tried it twice. And the first time I tried it, well, it all set up, I saw it somewhere with Advance Magazine. Nice form. Would you like this? You like that? You like the other? And as they came out of church at 8:30 on Sunday morning, they all said, "You said you can't preach Jackson. They said anything about you preaching Jackson." And all these friends came back and all these sex thoughts, they'd say, "Good." Or, "I like it." You know, all this kind of stuff here. And it simply said to me that I was looking for a technical commentary on the techniques of preaching. And I don't think the average person can get it. Even your real good friend who sits in the board of directors with me and came out, I could talk to your class a bit. I got to talk with him about whether he's talking out of his heart or out of conviction and the understanding of what is teaching, real teaching in terms of its form. But you know, they know the difference between a man with whom they can identify and one with whom they cannot. I'm sure all of you have noticed that attendance in some is sometimes very high in many churches where there's a very mediocre message, technically speaking, that is the usual pulpit form. And the converse is true also. Some churches have stupendous preachers, great guys. No one's there to hear all of it. For the next few moments, I'd like to talk about what makes that condition not only possible, but even probable. To do so, our attention must turn to the question of the pastoral image in preaching. More than anything else, a sense of pastoral commitment shapes the pastoral image. Commitment is not a very common word today. Perhaps it never did get much genuine usage. As pastors, we generally think of commitment in terms of our commitment to word and confession. Much of the present canonical brouhaha focuses on what that commitment means. In a second sense, we like to think of commitment in terms of our commitment to the mission and sense of God's church. Now, these are important uses of the word, but there's also an additional pastoral use of the concept, which is also commitment, that turns in at least two other directions. One direction is toward the question of parish staff, and the other is toward the people of the parish, and the kind of involved and complicated and potentially highly disturbing relationships which initiate when a pastor and people get serious about living meaningful lives together. We'll come back to those two areas for major considerations in the next discussion. But for the moment, let's work with the concept of commitment, especially as it applies to the pastoral image. Commitment is a very difficult word to define. I rather suspect it is indefinable, much like a companion word, love. It took me a long time to understand that love is nowhere defined. Not in the dictionary, not in the Bible. The Bible does say God is love, but that's hardly a definition. To define an abstract with an abstract is very unsatisfactory. Communication under those circumstances hinges on concurrent opinion and a commonly held view of the one abstract or the other, and that kind of concurrence doesn't always have sense. Love, and by implication, commitment, is always described. And that's why you'll have a million love songs. A million love songs. You'll never hear the last love song because you're trying to describe how love acts. Now, if you're going to talk about commitment, you're going to have to talk about how does commitment act. I begin by saying, if I'm going to describe commitment, that commitment is an attitude of giving. But more than that, it is a giving that is responsive to the desires and the needs to whom the giving is aimed. This aspect of commitment involves the voluntary placing of myself at the disposal of others, or setting aside, freely, a part of my life for someone or something. Unless there is this almost blind giving, all relationships at every level of the potential commitment spectrum are very tender and very tentative. And I didn't stand out here without a modest ask to ground. There are, I think, six young men of my parish at various stages in the canonical structure preparing for the ministry. I've had seven vicars. I've worked with, I think, four others. I've always tried to get to know the young men wherever they are. Right now, my associate is a graduate of last year. And if I were to go back and to describe the difference of the seminary that I went to and what these young men are saying to me, I think it's the word commitment. When the young men come out of the vicar to talk with me, they aren't committed yet. They are out to see whether this is what they want to do. I think when we went out on our victories, we were committed and we were trying to see how we could do it better. And I would generalize and say, that's the problem. We found it also in our district that there's a real wrestling takes place with a guy that comes into the church fresh out of the seminary as he tries to find out whether he's really ready to give himself. It isn't a question of intellectual preparation. And it isn't a question of his Christian commitment. And it isn't a question of his personal faith. It's whether I'm really ready to lay my life down and say, all right, I give myself to you for your purpose. I have a feeling 17 years out of the parish that what I'm talking about, the seminary, what I'm talking about, the professors here can understand. In all candor, you couldn't pay me to be a professor. Because I just don't have that kind of commitment. I just am not willing to go through that farther off, year in and year out, listen to the same question, and be patient and tolerant with the same foolishness every time and have some guy say something to me. I can't have the same kind of relationship with the guy. It's tough enough right there, you know. To really, now you see, not to get a past answer, because you get all the answers quick. You get wiser. See, most people don't get wiser, they just learn the answers. And if you've been around long enough, you're trying to learn the answers here. But a wise person is the ability to give the same patient answer with the same loving way over a long period of time. And that's what I believe commitment is. Unless there's an almost blind giving, all relationships at every level of the potential commitment spectrum are very tender and very tentative.
In application of this point, I would say that you'll never have peace in your vocation as a parish pastor until commitment has taken place. Without commitment to the pastoral office, you'll be constantly wrestling with vocational decisions that have to be reconsidered with every shift of the theological, the institutional, the family, or the personal circumstance. Every wrestling of the personal, congregational, district, or synodical waters will chase you back to the question. The big question before Denver is, my God, what are we going to do after Denver? Nothing. What's going to happen after Denver? Well, first of all, the sun's going to come out. That's first of all. Secondly, the Lord God omnipotent is going to reign. And his word is still going to be a power, and we keep that again. People who are committing themselves are always coming up with crises. Something's going to tear them apart, and that's tragic. If you don't have this commitment, you're going to always be asking, why should I go through this kind of folly wall? And remember, brethren, the folly wall level of life is fantastic. Fantastic. With this kind of indecisiveness, you study with a jaundiced eye every fiery scale public, whether it be for teachers or custodians or salespeople or doctors, and wonder why your salary shouldn't be the same or proportionally high. You begin talking about career, with career objectives and decisions based on career priorities. Your professional future will become paramount in your future, whether it can't be. Until there is a commitment to the concept of a parish ministry, there will be little peace in your pastoral life. Look at this thing. Being ordained is not the same as starting out life as a second lieutenant while harboring secret aspirations of someday being a general. On the day of your ordination, everybody's made a five-star general. There is no higher order in the Christian church. All the real advancement possible takes place at that moment. There is no genuine ecclesiastical pecking order other than that of servanthood. Seminary professors stand in the same line and on a peer level with the pastor's senior campus. You'll discover that the first time you're sitting in a pastor conference and one of your teachers comes back to do the effort. And you'll find out just how even he is with you. And I think he's a little honored that you accept him in that way as a peer. I've never known any professors who had a problem understanding that. And with that in mind, you begin to see that district presence, are servants of the servants of the servants of God. This is what Luther was talking about. He said a pastor is a servant of the servants of God. It isn't a hierarchical structure, it's sort of a deferral role. So that role is essentially clear. From time to time, as a parish pastor, you may be asked to take on additional duties, like watching over the youth program of district or lecturing at a Bible Institute. But what is that? The world gets excited over those things and sees them as marks of success. But you know, the people involved view the whole thing as far as with boy talent. Yeah, my mother is excited beyond words that I'm here. But the warning that I was every class of campus knew about this. And I started getting a lot of those from art and then on down the line that the only people that don't come are students. Very humbling thing, you know, to prepare these precious prayers. You know, I can see the pastor every morning is sitting there with all of his beauty and these guys are flashed out in front. But then I can't see. And you see, that's the whole understanding of what it means to serve. You go right ahead and you serve. You give the best you have. And you realize that as Dr. Westmeyer, a wonderful man of God, said, the work of the church is being everlastingly honest. Everlastingly honest. I remember I came home one time from a trip with Jed Rooney. And we'd gone somewhere, and we came back, they pulled in the back of this house, and I was down here telling my wife, mother picked me up, and Ruth Rooney came out of the house. By this time, Jed Rooney, just an enormous man, just an enormous man. A significant pastor, a remarkable individual, a real force in the church. His wife came out and said, the organist guy, and what he calls you, and this had a whole series of things. We were sitting in the kitchen drinking a glass of beer, and he was in getting a shower until the service room was done. He was almost 60 then, but I was at 30. And you know, that was one of the worst days of my life, because I said, as soon as I get home, my wife got this news waiting for me. You mean I got the next 30 years to keep going at this whole life of business, one right after the other? The answer is yes. everlastingly added. And you begin to understand that there's not a facetiousness when you say, I hope that by the time I'm 50, and I'm not stupid, but I hope that by the time I'm 50, I become a teenager. I think that that takes that long to go through tolerantly through all of these things and understand and respond and still have this quiet, joyful, infectious spirit of what it means to be God's person. Commitment grows out of the understanding that I am what I am because God made me that. That I may have to come to the seminary to meet the standard men at this moment in history have set for a Christian ordination. I didn't come to the seminary in order to become a Christian. I was that before I came. If perchance that happens to anyone while you're here, it's only incidental to the purpose of this institution. That means, as I view my talents, I am not preserved from the terrors of life and death by a handsome pension system, or a responsible salary, or piles of perquisites or letters of recommendation. I am preserved and sustained by the hand of the Lord. That in turn means that you can never threaten me with the removal of the pension system, or a reduction of salary, or an evaporation of perquisites, or a letter of friendship. Like all God's people of every age, I wake in the morning in wide-eyed expectations of God's mercy for me that day, knowing that if that fountain of mercy, His goodness, His forgiveness, and His grace ever dries up, I'm finished, regardless of how precisely secure I may seem to be. That means I look forward to the only legitimate retirement program God has ever blessed, and it's called death. And I lean on the absolute assurance of His pension system, the only one I know of, that will absolutely last, and that is eternal life. In the meanwhile, I live largely untouched and undisturbed by the ebb and flow of the events of life. I am a pastor whose life purpose it is to serve whatever people in whatever place in whatever service God puts before me. This is nothing new. Joseph faced with God, and Moses reckoned daily with the Son of God, and David faced the Philistines. That was their work. All their moments came and they went. But God did not come and go, nor did His purpose of salvation. So I face my 20th century selves, and my 20th century son, and my 20th century Philistine, realizing that these are only the forms in which the ministry's genealogies come to me, without letting them overwhelm me, or without the fear that if this particular moment slips by unattended or unanswered, all the history of God's purpose for man is spoiled. I've been spending a lot of time with blacks and militants, with every kind of ecological group. My parents loaded with scientists, you know, and I think that I've had guys in Vietnam since 1957, 58, the first ones were over there, heard this story over and over. Janet, I'd like to make something real clear. After the last bit of discrimination is resolved, and the last man is out of Vietnam, and the last speck of pollution is milked from the universe, and the last smidgen of economic or social injustice is erased, and the last line of heresy is eradicated from the seminary, and the last permission of God, and the last prayer set on the throne, we still have the full burden of our calling to face. Do not confuse concern for passing party with a commitment to ministry. And do not confuse the difference between the form of a concern and the concern itself. I was finally constrained after 17 years in the ministry to write a letter to the Luther Rift. I don't know if I have the wisdom to sort of hold that down. But I sat down and read that down to him, and I just got tired. I tried to recall all the names of all the enemies of the church that have been proposed in the last 17 years as the one, that if that one is stopped, or overcome, or overrun, or touched, or changed, or buried, the whole Jesus is there. You know, I couldn't remember the name. And still we stand here. Still we stand here by the grace of God. This might sound to some ears like 20th century do-nothingness. Most of its flesh and blood it might be. But it also has the feeling of Christian commitment. The way you discriminate between these two, do-nothingism and commitment, is from your basis for ministry and the intent of your lifestyle. We are always following our God into the universe. And we have always had a daily dependence on manna and bread. Without our walking commitment, the fire is stolen from our preaching
and the truth to my words and actions, and the genuineness to my ministry, and the attention to my Christian life. I left that last night and this morning with a development of pastoral teaching with some comments about the imagery of the various pastors, particularly as they apply to commitment. Now I'd like to flip to the other side of the perfect pew relationship and speak about things in the pew that directly affect people. You may recall that one of the things I tried to emphasize is that while I wasn't sure I was speaking directly to the subject of preaching, I feel that everything that we're trying to touch here in this case is tied up with preaching. The words I'd like to talk about are the words courage and teaching. I think your view of those two words will affect your preaching more radically than anything else shared in pastor. In a sense, your view of this matter may or may not make you heroic. We have a tendency to use the word courage as if it were a synonym for church building or congregation or for church. This is an example of a linguistic vagueness that hasn't particularly hurt us here before, but past misuse is about to be faced. The reason for that is we've never really meant to use the word courage for what it actually means, and now we must. We had a sort of an Alice in Wonderland approach in this instance, by which we have made this word mean for us what we want it to mean. But for me and for a growing number of other pastors, the word courage is taken on a very precise view. It has a geographical flavor, it implies boundaries with some sort of definable limit. In every legitimate use of this word, whether by government or law, or other than emphatically ecclesiastical usage, that's what this word means. It's more than high time that we also recognize it as such, at least in terms of our professional understanding. A bit what? I don't know whether the term is much used or such anymore, but even taught rather early enough to Jesus that the Christian layman was a significant part of scripture interpretation. Unless you knew the situation, the life circumstance, the historical and political realities of the moment, your interpretation of the text should be found yourself. Much of the question of right wing theology of the world today emanates from trying to hold the scriptures intact across more than 2,000 years without acknowledging that if you don't take the context seriously, for the textual, historical, or political, the meaning of the text can be lost or badly twisted. This reality is so common that I'm almost embarrassed to be stated here today. It's plain then that we now have the same care and concern for the area and the time in which we must teach the word. That's driving through Ohio not too long ago, I went to a perfectly fine German priest. The sermon was textually sound and theologically correct, but the application was tragic. The preacher, I guess, not the pastor, had decided it was necessary to emphasize the prophetic angle in the text concerning a question of appeal. He contemporized this concern by embarking on a lively analysis of Red Geiser's formula. I don't know if I've ever heard a more eloquent indictment of formula. The prophetic fact is that he was teaching in such a small class that after the sermon I inquired out of curiosity or a perverse curiosity whether the little town had any strength or whether in that congregation there was anybody who had any right to talk to the throne. The upshot was that there were no slums in question, and there were no landlords with any strike in the congregation. If most people had to do so with a sacred determination, that if they ever caught one of those miserly men who left the poor, they would certainly give him what they. This, for me, is an example of irrelevant teaching, made so by a failure to acknowledge parents and understand the specific nature of this in this instance. We can't afford irrelevant teaching. Too much has to be said quickly and clearly in our time for this sort of theological meander. And it's easy to make this kind of mistake in teaching. There are so many voices that want to tell us what the world and what our parents are really like. If we aren't careful, we'll not only develop instances of irrelevant teaching from our own mistakes, but by observing the mistakes and mistaken notions of others. Let me give you a few illustrations of how it happens. If as a pastor, you teach under the name, the cause is a uniquely mobile population And if you are the copy of Mick over in this case, teaching to a passing theory, you could be accepting of your preaching in which the parish, in the parish, which is invalid from the outset. I'm sure you've all heard the statistics that 1 in 5 Americans may be cured. Come by a simple extension of statistics to feel that every 5 years you have a complete membership term. Gentlemen, that 1 in 5 is a highly deceptive figure. This, when understood and put into context, gives a very different picture of what your parents will most likely be like. 1 in 5 do lose. But in that 1 in 5 are people like you. Every year, you make 2 moves of revenue. How many millions of college students are there? Every time a soldier is given a change of station, every time someone moves from apartment 4B to apartment 2B, they become one of the digits in series of statistics. The genuine mobility figure in the United States between 1950 and 1960 is 9%. How do you make it out? It's in a perfectly fine book that's available to anybody. Just this last week, I read in some of our synodical materials, 1 in 5 are losing. Baloney! Baloney! Now put this into a historical context. Would you be surprised if I told you that this has been about the average for the last 100 years? But in the period from 1850 to 1860, and since at that moment means to us with Lutheran, the actual majority figure was significantly higher, 11%. Only one period from 1930 to 1940 during the Depression, which can afford to lose, was the majority figure appreciably lower than it was had before the Depression. I cite this as an example to show how much statistical distortion is floating around that can badly distort your view of what it's like in the world and your parish, and that immediately affects your people. If time were available, I'd make some comments on the Spirit Church. The Lutheran Church is a middle-class church. It's predominant middle-class membership. Usually when that statement is made, the speaker is about to stand up for being parochial, or misrepresentative of the country, or irrelevant in our theology, or devoid of significant social concern. No such thing. Brethren, if we want a predominantly middle class church, all of that would be true. You know, the world isn't divided into three segments: lower class, middle class, upper class. Upper class is only about 7%. Lower class is only about 2%. The rest is middle class. And if we aren't represented there predominantly, we aren't responding to our world. That's why the picture of it is in such great difficulty today. So we are into the upper class. And as we tied into that, the upper class is always in considered a turmoil. And they are reacting typically to their status in life. And the Episcopal Church is saying, yesterday, we're being a upper class church or level. And those of you who will be serving the worst class subordinate, I don't know what that is. There's a wild note of bedroom community. Yes, there's something new in that, isn't there? I don't know. And a highly mobile upper executive class, or upper class executive. Do you know what is the least mobile segment of our society? The upper class executive. They need less than anybody else. And the poor guy is out there, for IBM keeps saying that thing, for IBM leader. But that is true. It is true. Some need. Some need a great deal at certain times in their lives. But one of the least mobile segments of that community are those making $15,000 in a job. And for whatever it means, the most fluid segment are those who make $3,000 a year and below, and it's because it's easier to move than pay rent, I suppose. And for those who live between 20 and 24. That's not sort of a slide commentary. This is why, you see, the commentary on effective inner city teaching is going to be the constant complaint of the guy that his leadership is going all the time. Because that's where the movement is. If he wasn't teaching effectively, if there wasn't this development of leadership and potential inner city, then there would be all of us. It's kind of a contradiction in what I just thought it was there. But I think the approach has got to be done very differently. As a second example of how you might misunderstand the real approach and what the teaching, let me comment on a lot of statements that by 1975 or 1980, and there seems to be considerable confusion about this case, the median age of the population of the United States would be 22 years of age or less, and there seems to be some confusion here too. These generations are these good teachers that you design to me. Well, it's about time that we look at this. We think youth are going to take over. There's going to be all kinds of radical changes in the past. This fact seems to foretell a period of great flux and confusion. Well, maybe. But that figure will look a lot different if I feed to you a few other tidbits from our past. And put one into this discussion. What does the figure about the median age being in a few years 22 mean to you when I tell you that the median age in the United States in 1816? But in 1820, it was 16.7. By the time the Civil War was 1924, that we didn't even get up to 22 until the turn of the century. Factoring into these figures all the significant historical moments our nation faced during the period of these of such modest median ages. Think about the documents written and accepted, the national policies formulated in past, the expansion of every level of concern our country experienced, and you at least get a different perspective of what these figures may mean to you and what we may forbid. And you've got to see after sometimes, figure out how old Walter was in 1850. I mention these examples because they will deeply influence your understanding of the time and life in which we live and you will see. And they are the background from which you will derive much of your view of the past. Ensure you do not let someone with the flaws and figures and the need for some kind of a tax strategy get you out of a legitimate understanding of life as it is. On the contrary, let a substantial part of your effort be exerted toward understanding the big picture so that mistaken notions not work your understanding and your approach to teaching the local text. Dramatic statements may be true, they also may be dramatic statements. By the way, 70 years of ministry has taught me something. Most of the time, whether it's Smith or Smith, really. Concomitant with this concern for a broad background understanding is, of course, a very real need to truly see and understand that area of real estate which constitutes your own home. Besides results and place to place. In North Florida, where I began my ministry, my parish was measured in a couple of times. In suburban Washington, I worked at a festival 3 mile range. In the inner city, you must work for sometimes as little as a block or 2 blocks. What I'm strongly suggesting is that this area, however large it is geographically, must be manageable and realistic in size, and secondly, you must truly know it and the people in it and their needs. I want to accent this for 2 reasons. I believe the perfect part of contemporary teaching is complicated. To be in ignorance about the realities of your people's lives is to be in irrelevance. Secondly, such understanding is fundamental to teaching towards a community orientation of parish life which will in turn allow for a future of your congregation. To reinforce this last statement, I would offer the following thesis, which I believe is easily defendable. In the next decade or two, congregations which are constituency oriented will continue to decline in both effectiveness and mass. They have a very limited future. Community oriented congregations which express themselves in parish terms, need never worry about having a connection. As a matter of perspective, I would cite those congregations which, by their nature, are constituency oriented. Here I mean ministries to the deaf, some military oriented parishes, some campus ministries, some social ministries. In addition, there would be in this category such congregations which are established as early mission outposts in certain sections of our country and the world. So, for instance, in the Southeastern District, the Florida Georgia District, the Southern District, they quite often would start a church in a given area. It's just the kind of be there and attract your kind of people. With these exceptions, I believe the premise will hold. But throughout that entire, a term of truth. Community oriented parishes are those which are aware and responsive to the needs of those who live around them. They are characters which are realistically bounded, boundaries their primary concerns by the limits of their own resources and the practical limitations which socio-political realities exist for. Constituency orientations are those which are intent on attracting a certain kind of person, the other one. Constituency orientations are strong on survival groups, are limited in their effectiveness, and are generally very structured in that sense. We have to move the ability. This attitude permeates their future. I came to Washington, which I should go doing. Half the congregation in Washington used to advertise, they call it this and say, building the nation's structure. He says, oh, you got down. I said, each point is the Lord's ministry. What in the world do you serve 2 million people? How do you do that? Because they were reaching so far, they reached so right in the front. The tragedy of Washington is how many churches are defined. We did a survey. We have 2 kinds of congregations in Washington. We have congregations which have parishes in the inner city and memberships in the suburbs, and we have congregations which have parishes in the suburbs and memberships in the suburbs. That's the 2 kinds we have. It's important when considering teaching that you understand this. If you are holding forth to your constituency or your occurs, your examples and your teaching things must be very generally known. You are free to land back whoever you wish, wherever you might be, as long as you don't get too personal in application. I've got a sample from a real interesting story about three old guys that were sitting in church there. And they didn't have preachers down there. They didn't really preach. And the preacher was preaching and he was saying, everybody that thinks is on the house. We see little man who's sitting down in the front row and he's giving his snack. He's lovely old cutting money. He's not going to go and get money on that street. And the preacher went out and said, anybody that might allow their neighbor's wife to come out. And the one cut went to the front of that street. Anybody that dances and plays cards is gone out. Damn, that street. And anybody that gets drunk is gone out. The one cut there said, good street, he's got nothing. That's what happens when constituency oriented church. As a young man, I left seminary to serve in one of the most unreconstructed areas of the country, and that's North Florida. I think it was more unreconstructed that time of South Georgia, and we just sort of lived together. As I left these hallowed halls, I felt secure in the knowledge that I had a leg up on every answer, or at least most of the answers, to the later concerns that you're hearing from now on to those years. 5 years later, as I left to go to Maryland, I didn't even know what to talk to him anymore. My dilemma developed from a predilection to shape questions to the answers that I had preconceived. I was preaching the principles, not people. Well, I knew all the principles of Christian theology and personal enlightenment. The difficulty was that I hadn't done elementary homework. I knew questions and answers, but I didn't know people. I think that after I'd made these unenlightened white people, taking them through the basics of Christian love, and showed them how they must open the doors of the church to black brethren, that all I had to do was announce the fact that the black fellow Christians would swim in. I taught some men our announcement well. As a matter of fact, it didn't even come. The truth of the matter was that I was an enormously ignorant man who assumed elementary things except what's true. And that elementary ignorance colored my teeth. I was a constituency oriented colour that people know and do. What I had to say was distinctively remote from the world in which they live and work or believe. Or as another example of elementary ignorance, I would cite the example of a real fine man, you'll be hearing a lot of him in the village, who graduated not too many years ago, he's my friend. He grew up in his understanding of faith together. He was serving in a small town in Delaware. He noticed after serving in Ohio that the attendance was erratic and very sparse. While most of the people attended some of the services some of the time, he attended all the time. At first, he interpreted this as ineffectiveness on his part, and then lethargy on that part, and finally indifference on the part of others. He questioned his talent, their faithfulness, and the future. When he sat down and looked over the town, he discovered that the main employer was a large chemical company. Most people worked for this company. This company in turn was on a three ship, 7 day a week with work program. In addition, the ships were rotated so that everyone had every shift sometimes. This means that regardless of the time of day or night something was planned, roughly one quarter of the people were working, and one quarter had gotten off and worked weekly. If you fixed the time well enough, you could set one quarter going to the ship stream, one quarter going off ship stream, and one quarter just going to sleep. This open feeling that oneness and fellowship and worship and the community of faith has suffered did not fall on deaf ears, as you see. It was developed in a worldview that assumed everyone got up in the morning at 8 o'clock, everyone got up at 4:30, and they had their Saturday and Sunday to discuss. Is Jesus himself? He was a question of truth. Among the fears which I feel are significant to preaching relevant things, I have doctors. A good commentary to go with a solid exegetical and theological training, in addition to census research of the area where you would stay, the population pyramid of your congregation, and a map showing where your people live. Throughout the last three, without the first three, this set of stage for splendid sociological and ecological studies of man in his environment. Throughout the first three, without the last three, is the set of stage for irrelevant research. Pastors who preach without a sense of courage and community are like men hunting in the dark. There's nothing wrong with the ammunition, or they're done, or they're considering how they're hunting. If they shoot off enough, the law of probability will become opposite. There's a story I read in North Carolina that says, even a blind hog finds an ace on something. But how much better to hunt in the light of day when you can see the game, be selective in your target, and have as much advantage as it humanly possible to accomplish what you're trying to do. Speak to the parents. Speak to parents' concerns. Speak to the knowable and the known. First find out what the parents is. Do not assume that by virtue of your regular reading of Time or some such magazine, that you have a clean perspective on what is happening in the world around you, or a complete understanding of the needs in a given community. You need more than that. You need to develop a style of church life and preaching that responds to the uniqueness of your area of primary success. There is more than one style of church life and hence preaching. In one area, facing one set of circumstances, your style of church life and preaching will be one thing. In another area, under another set of circumstances, it is quite another thing. The style flows from the parents, not the pastor. Different parish styles and preaching styles are not necessarily contradictory. They are reassuring facets of truth. There's no need to get exercised over varying styles of ministry or preaching. As long as they are in a broad context of commitment to the word and confession, the variations are almost infinite. I've taken this long on this aspect of pastoral preaching because I feel, as I've mentioned, it's the most difficult part of the sermon in application. I now visited most of the parishes in the Southeastern District, probably altogether in the mission picture, very soon up to 500. I am just amazed at how many people couldn't begin to tell you the first thing about this mission. First thing, and if you say to them, Census Tract, they say, what? Census who? Census, yeah. That's like the world given you something. That's an enormous insight into what's happening in your particular area. In order to seriously present law and doctrine in a proper way, I must have an understanding of the new world in which a given group of men lives. Brethren, look, there is no such thing as suburbia, there is no such thing as inner city, rural, urban, and the like. There is our only general classifications like student, doctor, and teacher. Before you're ready to speak, you must know student attention. What kind of student? What age student? Studying law. How motivated is the student? What are the students done? Only after understanding that kind of information can you zero in on whatever specific things you may wish to say to a given group of students. Then and only then can you hope to make significant applications to that group. In your case, as a teacher, you too must operate what is known. To know what is known, you must study the ground in which your individual congregation exists and come to know it like the back of your hand. For you have no information, stay clear. There is no need for hunting in the dark. Operate as children of light in the light. Don't guess, don't assume, don't extrapolate, Yes. And speak to the Lord. I feel it's about time to slip in a time of a duty before I go on. I'm making some assumptions about you, and expect the same assumptions on your part about me. All these comments are made in the light of my own making my own description for words and expression. The concern I have is not an assumption that I've been taught and believed concerning the enormous announcement that you and I have making teaching, but an extension and more specific application of it. Perhaps the two anecdotes for the past would make this point. Thank God, I also shared a little play that had been started in 1890. So I know Chris was what I need to miss from right here. So I've been in communities, I don't have been in communities for a number of years. We were out in the middle of the live oak in the flood time, and I read the minutes of the voting session. I came upon an interesting little moment of lucid history, as best I can remember it happened back here. In the early 20s, this little group of German speaking Lutherans, who had the only church in the area, were approached by their neighbors, it was known, but some, with a request to open their Sunday school to non Lutheran children. True to their sense of mission, these people extended a gorgeous invitation. After the first Sunday, the children turned out of a second meeting of the Board of the Assembly of this congregation concerning a complaint they had received. The neighbor of Jordan, Ken, urged his brother, the classes were conducted in German. Their parents were asking the congregation whether this could not be changed. After some discussion, the answer came back, no, we can't change the language. And we don't feel it too much of a demand that if you really want the gospel, you will be willing to learn it in the language in which the gospel is best presented. That's why the church is now closed. And you can be thinking of this. How many different places, and many, many different places. My plea is for parish awareness to support pastoral teaching. More than that, without parish awareness, you can't really have pastoral teaching. A guest who will have only a fragment of ministry to a series of individuals. While a parish is geographical reality affected by all kinds of sociological and political forces, there is in the parish a unique creature of God that is a subject of all these various views. And this creature of God, you can know. It is very important to Christians that we understand this intriguing creature. He is not interchangeable with all other men. Each man stands unique in his own creation, his own history, and his own distinctive quality. While some people may blur the distinctiveness of each man by treating men in all kinds of deacons, any attempt to do this is doomed to failure from the outset, especially if the boundaries are too thin. There is no such thing as a Southern, or a Chicago, or a Lutheran, or a Christian. There is no such thing, really, as children, youth, adults, old men. There are their parents, pastors, professors, and students. There are individual people who, in varying degrees, qualify for membership in each category, but they all agree to these classifications that are varying and changing like roles under the teaching of their history. There is a game going on, however, that is often played, and this game is called Act Your Role. Pastors start looking pastoral. In German, not German. Wives fall into their lifeless and St. Louis take on the flavor they think their residents in Christ. Families will act as ignorant as they think they are believed, and black people will try to take on the characteristics that many say they can take to their death. But this is true. This is all protective camouflage that we use in a society that majors in depersonalization. It's bad enough when political theorists and social scientists start viewing humanity as if it was a stable mirror which can easily be studied under a microscope and converted into formula. But you and I should certainly know better than that. I feel as if the chemists should help us understand that while there is a common humanity, with all our intelligence, each person stands out of the mass as one, a one to whom shares a distinctive reality, a one for whom Christ Jesus has died, and a one for whom God's intent is both personal and real. Our humanity pierces the front of worlds and penetrates to the core of the individual. So are our people. To forget this is to set the stage for some far misunderstanding about those in the earth of the church. Secondly, may I plead that you not fall victim to the error of trying to many likely have. These ones are not there to be manipulated
to earth, space, moves about. The outlines are there, but it is going to be the parts of a larger machine. They are anonymous digits to that number here. Each one is one individual. They are all their personal pain in their own realm of understanding, perfect and bleak and self, and ultimately, all by themselves as well.